And yeah, hello, internet. This is David Rovix with another Discussions with David broadcast that is pretty much every weekday, 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. GMT phenomenon. Every Tuesday, it's a Fifth Estate live program with produced by Peter Werby. And on Mondays, it's an open mic, which everybody is welcome to join, sign up onto at davidrovix.com/POMM for Pandemic Open Mic Monday. So there we go. Here we go. Yeah. And, but today, having my, I think it's the first time I've had the same guest on twice, because the last time, I mean, we covered a whole lot of ground and there was a whole lot left. I mean, that's often the case. So I'll be having other guests on a second time. But we were just starting to talk about the collapse of the publishing industry right now in 2020, and when what Amazon has been up to. We had covered a lot of other ground, and we had just started getting that there when we were over an hour of discussion, and I thought we should continue this in a part two, and this is part two. So with just a little further ado, I want to introduce to you once again. And if you missed the first discussion, I mean, you can hear it later, but it was from May 6th, the May 6th edition of Discussions with David, which you can find in various locations, including at if you look for the Discussions with David playlist on my YouTube channel, youtube.com/drovix, you'll find it there. You'll find it also in podcast form if you look for This Week with David Rovix on any podcasting platform. And these interviews are all being broadcast on the Facebook page of KBOO Community Radio here in Portland, Oregon, as well as on the Facebook page of Popular Resistance and on my various platforms, including also the Song News Network on Facebook as well, and YouTube, Periscope, LinkedIn, VK, and Twitch. And if you are in some kind of group that has a social media platform that you might want to host these discussions on, we are an expansionistic anarchist platform looking for more places to broadcast from and to and with. And now, really, now actually no further ado, we will now bring back here the founder of AK Press and PM Press and many other things, Ramsey Kanaan in Oakland, California. I don't know, the things, that was not very articulate. I didn't write down this introduction. I thought if we already talked, I can just wing it now, you know.
things are good. Yeah. They're occasionally useful.
things you know, has a lot of applications, really. Yeah. Ramsey, I wanted to pick up where we left off in terms of talking about publishing and stuff like that. But first, before we do that, it's been almost a month since we talked, and it's been a fairly eventful month. And I don't know how much necessarily you're on top of developments in your neighborhood, the way these strange times can be. We often know more about what's happening in London than we do about, you know, what's happening in our own town. But you got any updates on any front that come to mind for what's been going on the past few weeks? It's a lot.
Well, happening. You know, we're based, and I live in Oakland, California. Yeah. And not only were we the first state and the first region of that state to go under what has now become termed as lockdown, but we're actually still under lockdown. So nothing has changed. The governor is doing the usual kind of propaganda. I mean, of course, the Democrats, as much as the Republicans, actually want to get everyone back to work and damn the consequences as soon as possible. So it means that Democratic governors, including Gavin Newsom from California, are in this kind of weird position where they're saying that we're only going to open, you know, following guidelines, and deaths are going to fall, blah, blah, blah. But actually, we're going to open anyway. So they have announced that they're going to move into stage two of the kind of grand reopening of the economy. Stage two is patently just a piece of propaganda nonsense. So the big deal about stage two is that non-essential businesses meaning retail stores, will be able to open en masse for curbside pickup, which, if you consider what that actually means, is utter nonsense. As if 96% of retail stores doing curbside pickup will actually help them in any tangible way, shape, or form.
Because this was already, the thing is that, just prior to the pandemic, all kinds of retail stores were having lots and lots of trouble existing for a whole lot of different reasons, right? I mean, rising rents, but also just online business. And then
why anyone would want to go on curbside pickup when they've already been purchasing the same items from Amazon or Instacart or whatever for the last 2 months?
Yeah.
Why they would then want to wander around the streets and kind of try and arrange a curbside pickup. I mean, the whole point of retail, whether it's buying a book or buying a pair of jeans or a new screw for your leaky faucet, is presumably that you actually want to be able to browse, to engage with a more learned retailer or whatever. None of that is going to be facilitated by curbside pickup. So again, it's just kind of propaganda nonsense,
but also in a sense, I mean, on one aspect, I think of it in terms of like this suspension on evictions with the rent situation. I mean, it's kind of like just another way to kick the can down the road. Because these businesses might be able to survive for another month or two with curbside pickup longer than they might without any business or something. You know, it might just delay the inevitable by a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, maybe.
Or maybe even not. I don't know.
It's a very live question how much of the publishing industry will actually survive with or without curbside pickup. I mean, kind of for the reasons that you said, as we were talking about last time.
Talk about that aspect of it. I mean, there's another aspect of the publishing industry, which is like, but it was a particular situation with publishers because of the situation that Amazon has gotten us all into Amazon and whatever other for, you know, the convenience of Amazon or whatever, however this all happened. Now, what is it? Most book purchases happened through Amazon. Is that right? And then they just stopped.
It's not the majority. I mean, it's kind of multi-layered, I think.
Amazon. Paint us a little picture. I know anybody wants to listen to the last episode has some idea of publishing in the latter part of the 20th century, but we really didn't catch up to the 21st century much in terms of development.
Well, to briefly recap, my argument was manyfold. But basically, broadly speaking, the context is that publishing in itself has never actually been commercially viable. So publishing has always only been able to operate with some form of subsidy. That subsidy might come from the wealthy individual. It might come from the political party or the trade union. It might come from non-profit world, you know, being funded by arts councils or whatever. It might come on the micro level from massive amounts of self-exploitation. Mm. But either way, publishing has never been commercially viable. Secondly, the history of publishing is it's kind of risen and fallen with the kind of rise and fall of social movements. And again, I trace that back down to the English Revolution of 1640. The last time we had a massive social movement on a global scale was in the 60s, i.e. the 70s. And the book trade, very conveniently following my little theorem there, has, unsurprisingly, if you accept what I'm saying, has been in decline ever since. The first blow to that, the first nudge to that decline was the rise of the kind of multinational conglomerates who were kind of taking over publishing, the kind of Rupert Murdochs and the Bertelsmanns and the whatever, and they were buying up the independents. So people like Simon & Schuster or Penguin had hitherto been independent companies. They're bought up by these major corporations. And the first thing that corporations do, as they always do with mergers and acquisitions, is they downsized, in effect. So they laid off staff, they laid off distribution centers, and they laid off authors. Mm. So they're already kind of narrowing what was being produced. And like all major corporations, their logic of the economics behind it are, we'll throw everything at the wall and then see what sells and concentrate all our efforts on what sells. So what's going to be the next Harry Potter? What's going to be the next movie tie-in craze? You know, they went through a kind of comic graphic book craze. They went through a
whatever. When you say they laid off authors, were authors actually employed, like in the traditional sense, or it was more like just a lot of authors were no longer being used because they were no longer publishing obscure?
The old way of publishing, publishing, because it's always been not really commercially viable, was always known historically as the gentleman's profession, being a publisher. Basically because you had to be a gentleman of some means to actually be able to subsidize it, since you weren't doing it for the profit motive. At the same time, however, those gentlemen philanthropists, since they were involved in publishing, presumably believed in the literature, whether, again, the literature was propagandistic, whether from the right or the left or the liberal center, or whether it was because they believed in the value of literature or poetry or art, in the same way that rich people, you know, donate to museums, because presumably part of them thinks at least that museums are a good thing. It's not just to have their name on the building, or art galleries or whatever. So the same logic behind publishing was that insofar as gentlemen believed in it, they hence believed in, for example, cultivating an author. The expectation wasn't that the author's first book would be an international bestseller. The logic would be that you're cultivating a writer. So typically authors would be signed up for many books. You might have a 3-book contract or a 5-book contract. And the presumption was that the author's name would get better known. The author would develop their craft. You know, no one expects the first novel to be the best novel ever written, including by the author, et cetera, et cetera. So there was kind of some notion and some practice of investing in the authors. So what happened in the 80s was that these so-called mid-list authors, i.e. the non-bestsellers, found that they had their book contracts cancelled. So for example, say they were in book 2 of a 5-book contract, they'd literally have their contracts cancelled. So in that sense, they were laid off. Secondly, that they'd find their non-selling backlist, or certainly their non-commercially viable backlist, just put out of print. Mm-hmm. So there was, most famously here in the Bay Area in San Francisco, when when Rupert Murdoch bought, I've forgotten the name of the company now. Bollocks. Anyway, some famous, whose name may emerge. The first thing that they did when they bought famous publisher X was they literally cut 300 mid-list authors. So they cut 300 authors and their entire catalog from that list. For life of me, I can't remember. Mm-hmm. So that happened in the 80s. Mm-hmm. In the 90s, there was the rise of the chain bookstore. So the conglomeration, if you like, went from the publishing end to the distribution end. The chain bookstores put out of business all the independent bookstores. Mm-hmm. And of course, it was the independent bookstores and their myriad of guises who were the main disseminator of this wonderful array of books and literature and ideas, which wouldn't be, you know, put out there otherwise. So basically the destruction of independent bookstores, and also hence the distributors that carried independent publishers, in turn put a lot of independent presses out of business, because they kind of lost their natural base. Because once you're Borders and your Barnes and Nobles and your B. Daltons and your Waterstones in the UK have established their dominance and have put all their competition out of business, they're no longer going to carry anything but the bestsellers. Mm-hmm. So by the time Amazon came along, which was realistically in the mid to late 90s, the internet first became commercially available to us non-military types, I believe in 1994. Certainly that was when I actually moved to America, and I had an email account in 1994, because we were kind of always ahead of the game. Mm-hmm. And it was one of those email accounts that was like a series of random numbers and letters.
Yeah.
And it was in the dial-up days or whatever. And I would go on twice a week for 1 hour on my phone line and, you know, download emails.
Yeah.
So I spent 2 hours a week doing email in 1994. Yeah. Those are the days.
Yeah, yeah. Much better.
So Amazon started shortly after that, around about the same time. Amazon, of course, decided to do books first because of the ISBN numbers. Every book has an ISBN number. And there was already a database of 10 million ISBNs, which already existed. So the reason that Bezos chose books to distribute as opposed to everything and anything else that they currently distribute is because there was already a catalog of 10 million items.
Wow. So it just made it easy to just take that on. Interesting.
Put it into a different database and online, etc. As is now common knowledge, of course, Amazon made a loss for the first 10 years.
Wow.
But again, the shareholders didn't care.
Because they were achieving
dominance. The share prices didn't ever go down or whatever. They never had any problem getting infusions of cash because they were going for that total market dominance, which they now
total
have.
Total market dominance, which is a fascinating and horrible phenomenon, which deserves hours more discussion in itself. Because, I mean, when we're talking about this total market dominance thing and this whole business model of funding a massive corporation that operates continually at a loss until it takes over the market and destroys the market, it's been practiced on so many different platforms now, by Uber, by Spotify, as well as Amazon.
It's the ultimate logic of capital and of capitalism. Which, of course, extols the free market, but actually wants a closed market controlled by them.
Exactly.
And then, of course, wants to be bailed out by the state whenever that so-called free, i.e. closed market, fails. But again, that's a slightly different thing. So the rise of Amazon, I would posit, I would argue, really was merely another blow to an already kind of mortally wounded beast, beast being the book trade, and of which publishing is a part, obviously. So, I mean, Amazon just exacerbated that kind of slow disintegration. It exacerbated it, accentuated it, furthered its demise. But prior to the pandemic, Amazon was everybody's biggest single customer, but they still didn't have half of the market. Meaning, certainly, Amazon account for about 30 to 35% of our sales that are done through our distributor, meaning our distributor is the one that sells to the actual book trade. So, you know, I guess they're somewhere between a quarter and a half of everyone's business. So they don't have total market dominance. I mean, there are still other aspects of the book trade which equally have taken a massive beating during the pandemic. There's, of course, what's left of the retail business, stores, through the book trade, as well as there's a pretty sizable college market, meaning course text orders. And
that's all closed too.
Sizable library market.
Right.
Now, all of those various ways of selling books, again, have taken a beating for all kinds of reasons, which have nothing to do with Amazon.
Right. All kinds of other reasons, which have a lot to do with neoliberalism and the modern American capitalist state.
If libraries are no longer being funded, their budgets are being cut, hence they're not going to buy books.
Yeah.
If the neoliberal model of education is no longer as deep study, shall we say. So again, books are no longer being assigned as course text. Now you're getting course packets, which will have an article or whatever, a series of whatever.
And as you know from a lot of personal experience, the idea of having a storefront is just outrageously expensive in the current real estate market. I mean, it's like basically impossible. And also as somebody involved with the whole rent issue from a from residential perspective, when you realize the amounts that the landlords charge for commercial real estate for bookstores and that sort of thing, it's astounding that any of them exist. I mean, some if they haven't paid for the building decades ago, then they probably don't exist, right?
There's also two even bigger, broader issues going on, which affect all of it. One is, as I say, if one accepts my theorem, my hypothesis, my iron law of book selling, which is that the book, you know, ideas rise and fall with social movements. The fact that we've had no significant social movement since the 60s means, ergo, that there are no mass movements talking about producing, disseminating, discussing, debating those ideas. So what was a massive river, if you like, of ideas and discussion and debate and implementation and whatever in the 60s and 70s is now a kind of, I don't know, a little trickle, a little stream, a minor tributary. Again, however you want to push that analogy. Also, Amazon were part of that greater trend of the rise of adult illiteracy. Or to put it another way, the fall of adult literacy.
But let's just to be clear, especially for any of our listeners from less failed states than this one, in the United States, it has been the case for quite a while that, according to Jonathan Kozol, one out of three adult Americans is functionally illiterate. And that was true like 50 years ago. But the kind of illiteracy you're talking about is just people who can read, who choose not to, which is a rising phenomenon.
It's a yes and no. I mean, it is that, but it's all of that. So in a literal sense, including in, I mean, again, I grew up in the UK, but
which has a much higher rate of functional literacy, I believe, than here.
But that's falling. So adult literacy rates have been falling again with the neoliberal assault
in the UK as well.
What is the role of education? Education is to primarily make people obedient. Well, actually, primarily, as we've discovered during the pandemic, it's actually to warehouse children so the adults can go to work. The secondary function is to make them, prepare them for their own life of toil, which means teach them to shut up, sit still, do what you're told. And thirdly, it may be giving them certain skills which they may need to actually enter that world of work. Increasingly, literacy is not part of that. Literacy is for the elite workers, which would be, these days would be the tech workers, would be for the management strata, the foreman strata, if you like. Most people, again, literacy is, so adult literacy in the West, again, has been falling with the rise of neoliberalism. So since the 70s, that's definitely the case in the UK. It wouldn't surprise me if that's also the case in Denmark or Germany or Sweden or any of these fantastic bastions of so-called social democracy. Since social democracy across the board, including Sweden and Germany and Denmark, has embraced a neoliberal model wholesale. So there's that literal fall in adult literacy. What the digital world has also done is ushered in the destruction of long-form reading. And so if one thinks of the history of reading and hence the engagement with ideas, it started out as long form. The first book, the original battles over literacy and the original battles over idea were all based around the Bible. The printing press was invented, to print more Bibles and to print them in English and hence to break the monopoly of Latin. That was the whole Lutheran revolution, et cetera, et cetera. So from its outset, ideas were long form, meaning they needed some study. And again, whether one was literate or not, you'd have the person that could read would read the book or the pamphlet or the inflammatory article to one's illiterate comrades, workmates, whatever. So even the days when there was mass illiteracy, there was still a very high level of reading and thinking about the dissemination of ideas. as the kind of the 20th century has accelerated that, not only the speed of ideas, and also hence the alienation that one gets being bombarded with advertising and blah, 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 but also has, again, that's been accelerated and accentuated by that whole digital logic of, which is the opposite of reading. Again, to give a cliched example, when you and I were growing up, David, pretty much every household, so in the 70s and the 80s, pretty much every household read a newspaper. Mm-hmm. Newspapers, certainly in the UK, had circulations of millions. Now, again, I'm not talking the quality of the newspaper, whether it was the Sunday Times or the Sunday Mirror, whether it was tabloids, you know, with naked breasts everywhere talking about titillating gossip or what the Queen was doing, or whether it was the Sunday Times talking in more sophisticated terms about titillating gossip and what the Queen was doing. Either yeah. way, people were reading a newspaper. You know, the cliche was on the tube on the way to work, whatever, everyone's reading a newspaper. And every household would spend all of Sunday morning reading the newspaper. And so there was this kind of engaged literacy, again, at whatever level. And of course, it's literacy what's important. It's not even so much the ideas therein, it's getting people to engage with ideas.
Mm.
As I said, historically, the only idea that one engaged with for hundreds of years was the Bible. So radicals made radical interpretations of the Bible. Conservatives made conservative interpretations of the Bible.
When did that start changing? I mean, I know in the 18th century, I was reading. I've been on and off trying to do more and more research on this 19th century economist Henry George, because I have a song assignment to write about him, yeah. And he's a fascinating guy. But his book Progress and Poverty outsold the Bible when it was printed. And I think I don't know if that was a first, but it was the biggest selling book in the United States in the 19th century.
Edward Bellamy, who was a kind mm-hmm. of weird socialist, he wrote a kind of weird, very authoritarian, but utopia. It was called Looking Backwards or Looking Forwards. I can't remember now. I think it's called Looking Backwards by Edward Bellamy. And this was kind of turn of the century. I think it was like 1904 or 1906, whatever. That sold over a million copies.
Mm-hmm.
So again, there are books. There are many books which are literally bestsellers that sold astonishing amounts of copies of books, again, with a much lower population and a much lower literacy rate. Again, when Tom Paine's Common Sense came out in the 1790s in the UK, that sold 100,000 copies. And that was to a population of England at the time of only 6 million people, the vast majority of whom were illiterate.
Sometimes these books might have actually sold more copies than the number of literate residents, like, which, I mean, I think it says a lot about the importance of the ideas in the books to the average person, that they just wanted to have a copy of it, even if they couldn't read it. Huh?
So, but as I say, the dominance of capitalism, so in the late 20th century and even before neoliberalism, so post-Second World War with the rise, as I say, of advertising, of et cetera, that the whole concept of having sustained engagement with ideas has been replaced by the 2-minute or 2-second attention span. So, you know, your news, your in-depth news report has been replaced by the soundbite. Again, you can go down the line, you know, the Situationists wrote about it. You know, in the 60s, Society of the Spectacle. Again, they were mm-hmm. observing what had been happening post-war. So again, yeah. in the 50s, etc. And the digital age, in all aspects, has, as I said, merely accentuated that. So as I said, if people used to read a newspaper 30 years ago, 40 years ago, now at best they scan the headlines online. Scanning the headlines is not the same as reading the newspaper.
Mm-mm.
In the same way that sending someone a text is not the same as writing a physical letter. I would argue that sending a text is not writing. in the same way that scanning the headlines is not reading. So in that real sense, adult literacy is falling, as well as the literate sense, as well as, you know, what's the average, you know, what's the average reading age of someone in prison, incarcerated, you know, it's whatever, third grade. But also in the sense of we don't use it anymore. And like any muscle, and of course your mind is a very sophisticated muscle, if you don't use it, you're going to lose it. So the ability to even engage in what is called long form reading doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah.
Or again, has been greatly diminished. Secondly, there is now all these studies coming out, including by, you know, sort of conservative, you know, Harvard or whatever. These, again, not radical studies, or commissioned or written by radicals, saying that the internet and dealing with stuff digitally is actually changing the physiology of our brains. So again, we've evolved since 1600 or so, or the invention of the printing press, with this, as I say, this long form reading. Mm-hmm. And hence our brains have evolved for the last 400 or 500 years in that way to enable to do that. For the last 20 years, our brains have been rapidly changed to be being constantly distracted. Even if you do read the whole article of the New York Times online instead of just scanning the headlines or the Guardian or whatever the fuck, it's covered with ads, it's covered with hyperlinks, even which if you ignore them all, you're having to tell your brain to ignore them all.
Yeah. Whereas and you're also probably getting notifications on your phone as you're reading, exactly. Which you may or may not.
On the printed page, you're not telling your brain to ignore all the other stimuli and outside whatever. So the very nature of reading things online, even insofar as one is reading them online, is actually these, you know, whatever people have investigated, is actually changing the physiology and the makeup of our brains. And again, as you can imagine, not for the better.
No, and this has actually been studied as well. I know that there was a study of on the positive side of at some point before the invention of the GPS or before they became widespread, there was a study on London cab drivers that found that their brains were physically growing. That the part that memorizes maps was actually physically growing measurably, you know. And then conversely, you can assume, and I don't know if studies have been done, but I'm sure that our brains are now becoming flaccid and shrinking as a result of, you know, using GPS.
You know, the rise of Sudoku was demonstrably shown that playing Sudoku actually, which is largely done by retired people, is actually really good for your brain. Presumably playing it online is not so good, or doing online Scrabble or whatever. But so I say these are the kind of wider forces which are going into that. I mean, so again, the cliched response or my pat response is why is the book trade collapsing? Is actually no one is reading and there's no social movements. So everything else is more of the, you know, the nitty gritty. But without a social movement and without a literate population, we're kind of screwed.
Although the pandemic is not one of those small factors at the moment in terms of the lockdown.
But again, the pandemic is accentuating certain factors. So part of the problem with the rise of the internet, and insofar as we're interested in the dissemination of ideas, whether through art, culture, music, the printed word, the spoken word, whatever, is
there's the actual landline again.
Here's the joys of actual modern technology. You're gonna have to excuse me 1 second while I tell this person to bugger off.
Oh, you could just we could just take the phone call.
All right, I won't take the phone call. How's that?
Was it a potential customer? We could, you know, that could be part of the
silence. So I
that's always a bad sign. That means there's a recorded message coming on, but
My point being is, I actually have no idea what my point was. I've forgotten already.
But that's a good thing to start with. My point being, you sounded very authoritative. There he is again.
Maybe it is a persistent customer.
It could be.
Nothing can. Hey, Jessica.
This is Ramsey Kanan, founder of PM Press, answering his telephone.
Here, digits
live on Facebook. and YouTube and Twitter.
Yep.
When is the last time Ramsey Canaan answered his phone live on Periscope, mm-hmm. Facebook, YouTube, mm-hmm. VK, LinkedIn?
The expiration.
We could change the view of him answering his phone.
Repeat it publicly.
What's the credit card number? We all want to know. We also want to know what Ramsey's shirt says. But, you know, it, on at pmpress.org, not only can you find all right. sorts Thanks of books.
Appreciate it. All right. No problem.
But
all right.
You'll find also great T-shirts at pmpress.org, and we want to know what that T-shirt says, because I think you were wearing that last time, and that is Arabic, I believe.
It is Arabic. It says General Strike in Arabic.
Excellent. And
the reason I'm wearing it again is not because of my appallingly bad personal hygiene.
You haven't. You've washed it since then, I bet.
It has been washed a bit, nice claim, yeah. many times since then. Mm-hmm. But as the father of two young boys, I do an inordinate amount of laundry. So yep. actually the reality is, since I'm doing laundry every day, I tend to actually just recycle the same two or three sets of clothes.
Yeah, I do the same thing. All my old clothes just get dusty on the bottom of the pile, and I just wear the same three T-shirts. You know, if it says something about rent strikes on it, I generally like it these days. But Ramsey, the we got more viewers when you were answering your phone. Just so you know, I think they like they seem to like that.
I can do this then, if that helps it.
Maybe.
But as I was saying, so the digital world, I think that again, the pandemic has merely catastrophically accentuated these negative trends. So. Obviously, the history of organizing for a better world has involved human contact. What the rise of the internet did was not only did it make us all atomized consumers shopping online at home as individuals, but it also meant that the focus of organizing shifted from face-to-face human contact to being online. It was the rise of the online petitions, the moveon.orgs, etc., etc. And I would argue that was a demonstrably, so to speak, really bad form of organizing, as was demonstrated, so to speak, by the rise and fall of the anti-war movement during the Second Gulf War. If you recall, because of these massive worldly anti-war sentiment and massive online campaigning, we had the biggest turnout in human history of a demonstration all synchronized on the same day when it was March 15th, 14th, both depending where you were in the world.
Right. You know, February 15th, 2003.
Millions turned out against the war, and pretty much within a month, that entire anti-war movement kind of dissolved overnight as soon as the actual bombing started, which to me showed the kind of, so the internet was great for turning out vast amounts of people. It was really terrible, useless and ineffective for actually organizing a movement or a sustained movement.
It seems like, would you, I mean, at least in my mind, my experience with the internet and organizing was that when, in the days of, maybe it wasn't necessarily the internet that was the advantage, but at least compared to what happened since then, in the days when it was moderated announcements lists on email, and that was something we seem to be able to utilize in effective ways in terms of organizing. But once things moved on to Facebook and YouTube and other forms of social media dominated by algorithms that encourage conflict, things really tanked. But I don't know, maybe it just was not good before then. But I mean, in terms of movement organizing, I mean, I don't know how much intention there was to organize a real movement of the kind that we really needed with the kind of movement that shuts down the country until you get your demands met, you know, the kind of movement that actually works. Because I mean, in my mind, having big demonstrations doesn't constitute a social movement and doesn't
get
you very far.
Big demonstrations at the best of times play a part.
Yeah.
In those social movements.
Yeah, they play a part.
And I'm old enough to have been involved in mass social movements that were pre-digital age, where we, you know, toppled politicians, Margaret Thatcher in our case. We organized massive campaigns, of which demonstrations were part of that.
Mm.
But, you know, you don't mobilize millions of people to break the law consistently for 3 years with just a petition, whether it's online or the old-fashioned physical sense. But anyway.
What does it look like? And what is your sense? I know it's things are changing all the time, and we don't know, of course, what the federal government might do, if anything, to ameliorate the situation in any way. But what's your feeling about where things are going to go for you and PM Press, as well as for other similar entities over the course of the next, say, year? Any care to make any projections?
I don't know. It's tricky since there are so many unknowns, there's so many variables. Yeah. Obviously, the Democrats and the Republicans want and need are insisting that the economy reopens, and damn the consequences and the deaths, which of course are already rising again in the places that are reopening, etc. They're all going to be open, certainly for the new school year, because again they need the childcare.
And the Democrats, it seems, have basically given up on the idea of containing the virus. I mean, maybe if they had that idea at the beginning, they've realized there's no hope of actually joining the ranks of the competent countries in the world, and now we're just going to open up and let.
Well, you can't flatten the curve and have an economy.
But in other countries, they managed to actually contain the virus through partly through these measures, right? And here it's
they contained it in California. I mean, California is the second biggest hotspot after New York City, and we've had relatively few deaths.
Yeah, but that's not the same as containment. I mean, containment is when you contact trace.
We've had pretty good, you know, social distancing. We're still under lockdown.
Yeah, but they don't call that containment. They call that what is the term they use? Prevent. It's not the right word, but they basically preventing the death count from rising too fast. Mitigation. That's it. What's going on in the United States is mitigation, according to the virus.
No one has done containment. The people that did containment were the Chinese who did.
Yeah. China, South Korea,
authoritarian country ever. Again, I find it ironic, to say the least, that liberals and radicals and fucking social democrats here are saying we should do the Chinese model.
I mean, I'm not saying that this is necessarily the solution, because obviously you have to look at all the other consequences of doing that kind of thing to a society. There's a lot of other ways people can die. And obviously, when you look at what's happening in India and the Philippines and all kinds of other places, that, you know, it's clear that, yeah, you can't. I mean, if you're going to tell people to stay home, you have to provide them with all the means to do that, you know, and then there's still going to be all kinds of
terrible consequences. But also, the reason that the Chinese state is, which is, as far as I'm aware, is the only country that actually did quarantining, telling someone to stay at home, whether or not you have the virus, which is what all the social democratic countries do, including here in California.
Right, right.
If you have the symptoms, you call the hospital and they'll say, stay at home for 2 weeks.
Right.
I.e. infect the rest of your household and...
Yeah, you know, but in China, they were quarantining people individually.
So the Chinese did quarantining, meaning if you tested positive, you were dragged off somewhere else. Now, that may have been successful. The only reason they were able to do that is because it's the most surveilled state in the whole fucking world. And if you turn off your cell phone, you'll be arrested by the secret police for turning off your cell phone, because we can't monitor your every movement. Again, is that what we're asking for here?
Well, that's a very scary aspect of this whole situation, which lots of people are talking about. Where does this all go? I mean, whether or not this whole
idea... fucking liberals are castigating Trump for not declaring martial law.
Yeah, right. And the liberals were also castigating Trump for making peace, trying to make peace with North Korea. I mean, you know, I hope everybody recalls the 2016 Democratic convention which was dominated by 4-star generals talking about defeating ISIS and containing China and Korea. Oh, we got another customer. Yeah, we can't lose any customers at this point. We can't lose customers. The days of the landline still exist somewhere in the world.
No, I think they are. Hang on a sec. Was that UPS, Japan?
I can hold court here for a moment while we're waiting for Ramsey to return, rather than having him come back to the. There we go. Is he back? Let's see. Still on the phone. No, off the phone. Okay. I was just going to start talking about useless things, but you saved me.
No, sorry.
No, no. No, it's good. It's the real world. This is live.
The joys of,
The joys of not having an answering machine? Or do you have, of course, if you had the answering machine, then we'd just be listening to the...
I do have an answering machine, but then you'd actually just hear...
And they just read out their credit card number for everyone.
And then the answering machine message, and then the same message, so...
Yeah, so it'd take longer that way, even.
Yeah.
Good. Ramsey, do you still listen to CDs?
I do.
There's some CDs behind you.
On the back wall there.
Because you can't send Ramsey a digital file and ask him to press play, just in case anybody out there is thinking of doing that. You got to send him the CD or the book that's good.
It's partly because I'm a reluctant dinosaur who's actually not willing to engage with certain forms of more modern technology. But fortunately, PM has other younger people who do so.
Yeah, that's helpful. But PM Press is still putting out CDs, and I just have to ask, you just put out CDs as recently as last year, I think. Rob Johnson and Leon Rosselson, and I mean, are people actually buying CDs at all?
No,
I don't
not
do
very much. Mm-hmm. I mean, we are putting out CDs because we still do believe in the physical, tangible, objectifiable form. But CDs are cheaper to produce than vinyl, which is equally obscure. But we're doing it less and less because most people don't have the wherewithal to play CDs or vinyl, for that matter.
And for a book, you don't need a book player, and the battery lasts forever. So it's a bit of a better thing than the CD in terms of the modern attempting to sell physical things.
I mean books are actually gonna end up, or they already are, really kind of like vinyl. The average book sells 3,000 copies maybe
in its lifetime.
This is the average book across the board. I don't mean the average book published by PM. I mean, I do mean that too, but I also mean the average book published by Random House or Simon & Schuster or you name it.
Sells 3,000 copies?
3,000. If you have 3,000, you've got a good selling book.
In the book's lifetime or during the first year or the first week?
Book's lifetime.
Wow.
So again, a friend of mine is the production manager at Harvard University Press. And so his job, amongst other things, is he liaises the print runs, you know, with printers. He, you know, gets the paper and whatever, blah, blah. Guess how many books is the average print run of a Harvard book?
Gosh. It's in the low thousands?
400.
Oh, my goodness. like some author spent a year working on writing a book and researching for years before that, and then they published the book on Harvard's press and they put out 400 copies
on Harvard University Press.
I mean, that's like there's way more in the libraries in the country than that. There's way more libraries than that.
Again, as we were discussing earlier, it used to be part of the ecology of book selling or the book trade, is that certain books you could expect to sell a few thousand copies just to libraries. That was the academic model. We're only going to do hardcover because we know we're going to sell 1,500. Again, that was out of the window 20, 30 years.
That's been out of the window. Oh, my goodness. So, and what about, I know that PM Press does what a lot of other sort of, I guess, whatever you'd call it, like, .org type of entities are doing, which is this kind of subscription model where people subscribe to get anything that PM Press publishes in the mail, and they pay a set amount every year to be supporting the PM Press. And how has that model worked?
Very well. I mean, one would pay $30 a month, and in which case you get everything that we publish, which is typically between 2 and 4 books a month. We do sort of about 35 to 40 books a year. So it's a fantastic deal for the subscriber, so to speak. It's even better for us because it's not only is it a guaranteed sale, but also it's a guaranteed sale. Typically, we make more money, and hence the authors do with their royalties, than we make as if it's sold through the book trade.
Mm-hmm.
So it's because the book trade, everyone takes their cut, whether it's Amazon or the distributor that sells to Amazon, etc. So we actually, selling 3 books, say, for $30 means we actually get more money back per book than we do if those same 3 books had been sold through our trade distributor.
What is the cut like with distributors and with Amazon? As I was just hearing, it's been in the news a bit recently with these restaurant delivery apps that are becoming so popular that they take an incredibly high percentage, which makes it basically they're taking the entire profit margin for the restaurant.
I mean, again, it's one of the, without getting too much into the nitty gritty of the machinations of the book trade, but in terms of the distributive mechanisms, whether it's mainstream bookstores or whether it's the distributors or whether it's the like of Amazon, their financial model is actually not set up to be, they don't make money by selling units. Again, we famously discussed Amazon sold everything at a loss to capture the market. So their dissemination model is actually charging you for services and selling space. So Barnes & Noble, for example, when you walk into a Barnes & Noble, well, not that you can do that anymore. In the old days, and perhaps once again, when you walk into Barnes & Noble, every book that you see that is face out, every book that's lying on a table, meaning that you can see every book that's not spined out, every book that's on an end cap or is faced out on a shelf, the publisher is paid for that space. Every book that you see is in the window. The publisher is paid for that space. I know this because we're offered these same deals. We can have, copies of our book on the front table of Barnes & Noble's top 200 urban stores.
Mm.
They will place 2 copies of each of our books in their top 200 stores. To get that deal, we pay on top of Barnes & Noble's discount. We pay $2 per book just to have them displayed. Meaning Barnes & Noble can then return all of those books as unsold a month later, and we've still paid them $2 a book to display them. Mm. We'd pay even more to have them in the window, to have them on end caps, et cetera, et cetera. So similarly with our trade distributor who sells to Barnes & Noble, sells to Amazon, they charge us for all their services. So they make money from us whether or not they actually sell any books. Similarly, Amazon take a 50% discount. Amazon take another 5% discount of whatever the list price is, what they call a co-op fee, which Amazon claims used for their advertising. But so Amazon can then return all the books again as unsold, and they've still made the 5% of that invoice, if I'm making sense. So Amazon actually don't have to sell any books.
They just make money from...
Make money. Exactly. As we know, Amazon don't actually make money in selling books. They make money by capturing their market and doing whatever the fuck they want with it. I mean, actually, Amazon make their money these days by selling the cloud to the Pentagon. It's actually how Jeff Bezos makes his billions of profits. It's not on selling books, and it's not on selling belts or cookers or everything else that you can buy on Amazon. Hmm. It's actually by selling now digital space to the Pentagon.
It's hearing you lay out some of those little who's taking cuts and how they're making their money, it sounds so much not surprisingly like the music industry. And also it sounds a lot like what Matt Callahan described in his book published on PM Press, The Trouble with Music, where he talked about how, like, yeah, there's so many people in the industry making money, they just don't include like songwriters or musicians.
You know? Well, I mean, it's the same corporations in the industry. You know, it's the same, you know, publishing is dominated by now three big corporations own everything. They're the same three big corporations that own all of the music industry and that own all of entertainment and own Hollywood and whatever, you name it. It's the same, you know, Sony, it's the Bertelsmann Group, BMG, and Rupert Murdoch, News International.
And they are the same three corporations who dominate the music industry as well as movies and publishing?
Of course, yeah. I mean, you know, they own, you know, Rupert Murdoch owns whatever, these different publishing groups. They're the same company that, you know, Rupert Murdoch owns Fox News. He owns, you know, all these... movie, you know, whatever. I mean, it's the same few multinational corporations which own, you know, yeah, most of the world, in the same way that any and all foodstuffs that you find in your supermarket or you find in your health food store are owned by Unilever or Coke. Anything that comes in a package in your local health food store, 98% of that is manufactured and distributed by Coke and Unilever. Coke being Coca-Cola.
98% of the products within the package. Not just the packaging, right? Wow.
Yeah, not the packaging. So, you know, Nature's Path, you know,
yeah,
cereal or blah-de-blah, blah, you know, whatever. I mean, everyone knows now that Coke bought Odwalla, for example.
Yeah.
No one knows that Coke also owns all these health food brands that they own. I mean, I know this because an old friend and comrade of mine worked at Rainbow Grocery, which is this huge grocery store, health food store, call it what you want, in San Francisco, which came out of the food revolution in the Bay Area in the 1970s. It's a huge store, wildly successful, you know, has hundreds of worker owners, so to speak. He worked in the packaged goods department, which means anything that's not, you know, anything that's a foodstuff, which is comes prepackaged. It's in a bag or a, you know, a tin, whatever. So your corn chips, your tin of beans, you name it, your soy milk, whatever. He said they actually only had two suppliers, Coke and Unilever.
Wow. God. On that note, Ramsey Kanaan, thank you so much for joining us. I think it's a perfect note to end on. Plus, it's been an hour anyway.
But, you know, that's not the problem. As I say, that's not the problem of the pandemic.
Yeah, that's right. No, that was pre-pandemic. That was the crisis pre-pandemic. Yeah, yeah.
And the only winners of the pandemic are going to be Coke and Unilever and Amazon and Zoom.
Yeah.
You know, the tech industry are going to come out even stronger than they were before the pandemic.
Oh, yeah.
Or Walmart.
Yeah.
The rest of us are kind of fucked.
Yeah. Yeah. And speaking of being fucked in terms of what's happening with the internet, I think it's a relevant thing to mention that, like, for me, you know, my viewership on Spotify has increased by something like 20% because of the pandemic, I'm sure, because people are spending more time listening to music and sitting around at home. But has the money increased? No, not at all. you know, because as people may or may not know, the way they calculate how much the artists get has to do with the amount, the percentage of the overall stream that you're getting, not the number of streams. So it doesn't matter. Yeah.
So actually your income could go, even go down.
Yeah, it could.
More people are streaming.
It could. It's about the same as it was so far, you know, but it could potentially even go down. Yeah. And get more. Yeah. Streams. Yeah. Thanks so much for joining me. We'll have you back sometime soon, I hope.
Well, it'd be my pleasure. Thanks very much.
Take care, Ramsey. And that was Ramsey Kanaan, founder of PM Press and founder of AK Press before that. And we'll see for how much longer. That was a little assessment of the current state of a lot of things. And you can find all of these discussions archived in the Discussions with David playlist at youtube.com/drovix, and also in podcast form if you search for This Week with David Rovix on any podcasting platform. And I will be talking tomorrow to longtime professor of political economy at Evergreen State College, and I'm hoping to get some thoughts from Peter Bomer on the state of the current economy, which is a big question. We can easily spend an hour on that. And thanks for listening, everybody. And if you want to support my broadcasting efforts, feel free to make a donation at paypal.me/davidrovix, or become a member of my community supported art program at davidrovix.com/subscribe. And if you are a rent striking or rent strike supporting person and want to know what I'm up to with this rent strike project here in Portland, artistsforrentcontrol.org has a lot more stuff on it now than it did a few days ago. And thanks again for joining me for this discussion, and mutual aid will get us through. Don't pay the rent, and I'll see you soon. Bye-bye.